Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Karen Dolan. Karen Dolan is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She directs the Criminalization of Poverty Project there. She also is a member of the team at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her public scholarship and activism is focused on domestic poverty and local democracy slash empowerment. Her latest publication, which we will be talking about, is called The Poor Get Prison: The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty. And I believe you can find it at the IPS website, ips-dc.org. Karen Dolan, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
David, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on here. I don't know how I've gone so long without having you on this program. This report is rather remarkable, and I think in many ways will surprise many people, including people like myself who thought they knew something about these issues. Maybe we should start with what lands poor people in prison? What?
Well, it's usually not violent felonies, but almost everything else. So it's really quite shocking when you look at all the different ways in which people are criminalized, essentially for not having enough cash. In the report, we look at everything spanning from what a lot of us know about in terms of drug testing for TANF recipients, or welfare recipients, or for accessing food assistance, to children being criminalized in poorer schools for childish behavior that usually is just a visit to the principal's office, to just citizens who may be playing their music too loud or neglect to use a right turn signal at a stop sign, or as we saw recently in the tragic killing of Walter Scott, a broken taillight.
And there can be sort of a multi-step process here, right? I mean, you don't always go to jail straight from having the broken taillight.
That's right. What usually happens, and it happens often as a result of aggressive policing, which we can get into a little bit later, but the thumbnail version of it is you can be stopped for something like speeding or a rolling stop or a broken taillight, and at that point, when you're in a situation, especially in low-income neighborhoods, and disproportionately if you're Black or Latino, it can escalate either through finding out there is an outstanding warrant for another misdemeanor charge, for a debt, for perhaps the same taillight that you didn't have the money to fix when you were pulled over before, but you're on your way to your job so that you can get the money to fix the taillight. Or in the case we saw with Walter Scott, although we don't have all of the details, that there may have been an outstanding arrest warrant for non-payment of child support. And these kinds of debt-related issues, traffic-related issues, misdemeanor issues, are not the kind of things that, A, should land someone in jail in the United States, and certainly not result in physical abuse, tasering, or, God forbid, death.
The aggressive policing that leads to these kind of charges and fees disproportionately happens to certain groups of people. Is that right?
Yes. So what we see more broadly, more generally, are poor and low-income communities is where the aggressive policing takes place. Within that category of low-income and poor people, the subset of African-American males, as well as Latinos, also are disproportionately affected within that affected group. But we've seen, this has been going on for decades against poor people, and racial profiling, of course, has been going on for longer than that. But what we have seen an uptick in since the recession is more of a squeezing of state and local budgets, especially in poor and low-income neighborhoods, where they don't have the revenue, let's say, of high property taxes. And the Department of Justice investigation really highlighted this in Ferguson and showed that it the police department was in the service of collecting fines and fees and revenue to go into the city budget. And so we have the police forces, not just in Ferguson, not just in North Charleston, South Carolina, but in high poverty areas around the country and in areas with high minority populations around the country, where the police force really is a very aggressive, often violent debt collector.
So not only do we as a society not tax the rich and not provide services to people, but we actually are raising funds for local government off the very people who don't have any. I mean, surely this is an unsustainable policy.
It is an unsustainable policy. I think it's also an underreported and lesser known driver of the increase in inequality in the nation. So you can look back at, we spoke about criminalizing people, assuming that poor people are criminals when they're trying to access welfare assistance or they're trying to access food assistance for their children, and they are required to submit to drug tests, even though there are no studies to support that single mothers accessing the welfare system have problems with drugs. But you don't see drug testing at the other end. The CEO of ExxonMobil isn't required to undergo a drug test before receiving taxpayer subsidies. You see, recently in Kansas, they proposed a bill to stop welfare resistance, to prohibit welfare recipients from spending money, I think it was on spas or cruises, with there being absolutely no evidence that poor people are spending their meager cash assistance on cruises and spas. But it is part of this mentality where we are putting the onus of all of the ills of society onto the very people who are unable to defend themselves, while at the same time giving a pass, not just a pass, to wealthy people and people at the top, but much more welfare assistance, much more subsidies without regulation. And yes, as you say, it's not sustainable. It hasn't been sustainable. And until we realize that this is what's going on and that this also underlies a lot of the police brutality, we're not going to be able to close that gap in between the rich and the poor, nor are we going to be able to say that we live in a decent democratic society.
One of the phenomena that you point to is the sort of rebirth of debtors' prisons. Can you explain how we have debtors' prisons now in the United States?
Yes, so we think of debtors' prisons as something in a Charles Dickens novel in London, England, in the 1800s. But debtors' prisons have been illegal in this country for over 100 years, and the issue was even revisited in the 90s in a famous case, Bearden versus Georgia, where a young man was imprisoned for nothing more than being unable to pay his debt. That is not legal in the United States. But there has been a resurgence in this practice as we've seen an increase in the fines and the fees and the aggressive policing. When you see the increase in this kind of fining for misdemeanors and targeting poor people, the people least able to pay, then naturally you see this rise in debt. If somebody can't pay and then you are fining them for not being able to pay, it quickly becomes unsustainable, and many courts are skipping over the step of the ability to pay hearing, and a judge is making a summary judgment based on someone's appearance perhaps and sentencing someone to jail. And then you have a problem when you're incarcerated. More and more jails and municipalities are charging the jailed person for his or her room and board. And if you are offered probation as an alternative to incarceration, more and more states don't have the funds to administer the probation and are hiring private probation companies. And then the alleged offender is made to pay fees for their own supervision.
You take away a person's possibility of earning any income by locking them up, and then you charge them for being locked up, and then when you release them, they're in debt for having been locked up, or they have fees to a probation service that's a private for-profit company. I mean, it seems intentionally self-destructive.
Well, I think there is an overlay of social control in this pervasive system. There is a pervasive cultural idea in this country that poor people are responsible for their own poverty, that they are poor because of a character flaw. There is deep structural racism that assumes out of the box that black men especially and single women, single mothers, Latinos and immigrants are by their very nature criminals. So you have that cultural component. And then you overlay that with the financial problems that have resulted from the financial collapse and state and local budgets, especially in high poverty areas, that really are squeezed. So when you put the onus on the backs of poor people, you not only satisfy that cultural need to punish the poor and feel somehow vindicated, but politicians love it because the taxpayers aren't paying for this. We're saying this isn't coming out of your taxpayer money. This is coming out of these poor criminals that deserve, they need to be paying for this. And the private prisons and probation companies are profiting off of that. So it looks on paper like a win to the politicians and the municipal budget, but in reality, it isn't. And so when you incarcerate someone for their inability to pay a debt, not only is that illegal, but it is not sound fiscal policy because it costs the taxpayers much more in the end to incarcerate someone even as you're paying, even in the places where people are charged a daily fee for room and board.
Prison ends up costing a lot more than schools, and yet the policies in place suggest a school-to-prison pipeline.
Yeah, so that's another piece. There are so many pieces of this puzzle that make up the way in which we criminalize poor people and also black people and immigrants. And our report doesn't touch on all of them, because it's almost impossible to touch on all of them in one place. But the school-to-prison pipeline is particularly insidious because this starts targeting children from preschool all the way through if they can make it through high school without landing in juvenile justice detention centers. You've had, since Columbine and then again since 9/11, and a ramping up of police presence in school. And also in the 2000s, you've seen this implementation of these zero-tolerance laws that are supposed to be aimed at anti-bullying. But when you combine those in a low-income area where it's presumed that the poor children and especially black young male children are criminals from the time they walk into the school, and the police are policing the hallways outside of the classroom, when you have something that would be a childish infraction, scribbling on a desk, speaking back to the teacher, insisting on a bathroom pass, which would normally, in a higher income school or a school with higher income white people children, they would be sent to the principal's office or they would be given detention or docked a grade or whatever kind of normal childhood discipline, when the police are up and down the hall, they're called in, and those children end up before a judge.
Yeah, where my kids go to school, there would be no sort of so-called discipline. They would receive guidance and assistance and counseling and help with whatever was causing them to speak back to the teacher or whatever. It would be treated as a learning process, not as a criminal act.
That's right, and that's not the case in lower income and especially areas with high minority populations.
I think the United States now, tell me if you know I'm wrong, is the only country now that has not signed on to the Treaty on the Rights of the Child, which requires that public policy first consider children, bans life imprisonment for children, bans prosecuting children without rights to a lawyer, and so forth. Is this something uniquely American that we are willing to abuse children in this way?
The United States routinely chooses not to sign onto a lot of these treaties that have to do with human rights because the United States government takes the position that we do not abuse people's human rights. Now, we know from the existence of the school-to-prison pipeline, from the high incarceration rate that we have as compared to other countries, developed or undeveloped, and because of things like the high rates of racial profiling and the abusive police practices exposed in the Department of Justice reports, and because of our higher poverty rates than a wealthy country should have, that indeed we are not respecting people's human rights. And the Department of Justice report highlighted the ways in which we are violating people's constitutional rights in a systematic way. Now, I will say, with that said, juvenile justice detention rates have been coming down, as has the overall incarceration rate. But what those statistics don't show is underneath that, the rise in punishment through fines, fees, and or incarceration, the punishment for misdemeanor crimes, for lower-level crimes. And that's something that is driving a lot of the police brutality. Again, as we talked about at the beginning of the hour, this increase in the gap between the wealthy and the poor. And that is something that I think our report is trying to put a highlight on, trying to expose, so that we don't just look at the bigger picture of we're a democratic society, our incarceration rates are coming down for violent crime. You know, the juvenile justice system, we're trying to find alternatives. And there have been some very successful programs for finding alternatives to juvenile detention centers. But at the same time, the amount of children that end up before a judge and who are put on a criminal path is on the rise in many of these poor income cities.
We're speaking with Karen Dolan, and the report is called The Poor Get Prison. Yeah, a couple of things that really struck me in the report, Karen. One, that the figure of some 7 million people under the control in some form, probation, prison, etc., of this so-called justice system. And another, that in local jails, three-fifths of the people in there have not actually been convicted of anything. How is that constitutional, and how is that possible?
Yes, so that has received very little attention, and we have people languishing in jail without yet having their day in court, and we saw that too in Ferguson. So there also was, Ferguson is really a microcosm for this that's happening nationally. And there are some lawsuits now for people that, with misdemeanor charges, end up in jail for something like 7 days before they have had their day in court. No, this isn't constitutional. And it also isn't fiscally sound. And as we said before, in some cases, people are offered this alternative of probation, which ends up being a trap as well, because they then are responsible for very high for this probation, and if they miss a scheduled payment, then they are back in jail. so the entire system really is indicted from the time of pulling somebody over to how they're treated once they've been pulled over, to what happens in court, to what happens in jail, to even when they are afforded the chance to have some representation, so poor people can't afford high-priced lawyers to really know what their rights are, to really have somebody fight for them. And the public defenders are far overstretched, and in many states now, the way the municipal systems are dealing with the fact that there's not enough money for the for public defenders, poor people have to apply for a public defender for a fee from $50 to $200 to apply for their free public defender.
So you can be charged with the crime of not having $50 to pay a fee, and then to have legal representation, you must come up with an additional $50 for another fee for your constitutional right to representation?
Yes, that's your application fee for your free public defender.
Absolutely incredible, and I like to hope that a lot of people don't know these things and would get outraged if they do. I was struck as well that in the report you cite the sort of case where someone is arrested and not convicted, but and never mind that they can go to jail pre-conviction and so forth, but that the arrest record stays a part of their record despite not having been convicted of any crime, which impedes their ability to get a job, as of course does having a conviction on the record.
Yes, so this is really insidious and really terrible. It's what some criminal justice scholars call collateral consequences. So whether you've been convicted or not, if you have an arrest record, and or if you have been convicted, served your time, and you know paid your debt to society, when you come out of jail, whether you've had an arrest without a conviction or an arrest with a conviction, it makes it that much more difficult to get a job, to get housing, to get mental health help, to access public services. And especially if you've been in jail for any amount of time, you desperately need those services in order to be able to get back onto your feet. But if you've had certain convictions, you're unable to access that, even housing or help with food. And if you've had an arrest, as you just said, without a conviction, that still is going to come to haunt you when you have to apply for a rental for an apartment, or you apply for a job and you have to check that little box that says, have you ever been arrested? And you have to check yes. Now, there has been a movement in the country called Ban the Box that many of your listeners may know about. And this is a wonderful movement started by formerly incarcerated people in South Carolina, in San Francisco, a group called All of Us or None, and it's been picked up by big national organizations like the National Employment Law Project and Jobs with Justice that have really done a good job in helping to spread the campaign, trying to do away with that box. But that only goes so far. So that might get you past the initial application into the interview phase. But it also, with the age of the internet, an employer can find out if they want to whether you've been arrested or not. And so these can have really far-flung consequences, very damaging consequences that can follow you through a lifetime for something as little as perhaps jumping a turnstile in a metro station when you're 17.
It seems to me that in the United States, people buy self-help books and guides and CDs by the gazillions. There's no more popular story in movies and television than someone who improves themselves and transforms and becomes something better. But all of these policies seem to be based on the idea that, you know, someone who has once been unable to pay a fee for a parking ticket is hopelessly, irredeemably evil and untrustworthy. I mean, do people in general think that about the rest of humanity?
Again, I think that goes back to the culture in this country that's perpetrated by, for instance, talking points at Fox News or conservative talk radio, that people who are poor are responsible for their own abysmal conditions, rather than looking at the structural reasons and all of these things that we've been talking about today, plus many more, including structural racism is very strong, that the people who are buying the self-help books and taking the classes and doing yoga are not the people who are low-income and poor and struggling to get by, and the people unable to fix their broken taillight. And I think that it is part of the very fabric of this nation that we blame people for their own bad circumstances, and we reward people for being born into privilege.
It's a remarkable report, Karen. The poor get prison, the alarming spread of the criminalization of poverty. We haven't even touched on various sections, including the criminalization of homelessness, the civil asset forfeiture, the seizing of goods from poor people. But I think everyone will have to go and read the report. Just before we run out of time, what do you recommend? What can people do to help? I mean, some of what you've been describing is illegal. Some of it should be illegal. What can best be done?
Well, one thing that would go very far in really helping people get out of bad circumstances is a raise in the minimum wage. So people need to have access to good quality jobs that pay a living wage, so they're not stuck and vulnerable to this kind of aggressive policing. We also need to enforce what is the law, that people can't be thrown in jail for a debt. And we didn't get to the area on the criminalization of homelessness, but there are just basic human functions, sitting, walking, sleeping, that are criminalized for people that don't have enough money. So we need to not criminalize basic human functions, not criminalize debt, not criminalize children in schools. And we need to have a living wage whereby people can afford to care for themselves and their family. And if their taillight is broken, they can afford to go and get it fixed.
It's an excellent recommendation and an excellent report. Karen, I'm very grateful to you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, Dave.
This is David Swanson. I'm just back from a great event in Baltimore. You can read the text and see the video at davidswanson.org. I look forward to seeing those of you who can be in Houston this weekend, April 25th, for a tremendous anti-war conference with lots of great speakers. I hope to see you at the UNAC convention in New Jersey on May 8th and at Left Forum in New York City on May 29th. Keep up with everything I'm about at davidswanson.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.